he was not permitted to land because, in the view of the Home Secretary, it would not be in the public interest for him to be allowed into the United Kingdom. Lenny Bruce did comic routines about nuns, Negroes, whites, Jews, Paul Robeson, the Kennedys, Irish priests, sex, and Dracula. The scene is Transylvania. It's dark. It's late. Count Dracula and his party are trying to find a bed for the night.
Who are you? I've never seen you before. You're a stranger in Transylvania. What is your name? Who are you?
Permit me to intrude, my dear. My name is Count Dracula.
Oh, you sound pretty wild. Come in, come in, come in.
Myself, my family are looking for lodgings for the night. And we don't want to be disturbed. Here's 10 years' rent in advance. All right. Now I will take my family out of the boxes.
Pop, it's so good to be out of the box. Papa.
Shut up and drink your blood. Bite Mama good night.
A parody of the Boris Karloff movies. Another frequent target was racial prejudice. At a time when the black rights movement was gathering momentum, Lenny Bruce performed How to Relax Your Colored Friends at Parties.
I didn't get your name.
Miller.
Yes, Mr. Miller.
Nice to meet you.
Hey, Joe Louis, the hell of a fighter.
Yeah,
hell of a man. Hell of a... Now to be another Joe Louis. At Bojangles. Christ, could he tap in?
Oh,
you tap dance all yourself, huh?
Yeah.
All you people can tap dance, I guess. You people have a natural sense of rhythm. What's that? Born right in you, I guess, huh? Yeah, boy. The way I figure it is, no matter what the hell a guy is, if he stays in this place, he's all right. That's the way I look at it. That's what's causing all the trouble in the world. Everybody, like, well, here's the Joe Louis. Joe Louis was a guy who, the way I figured, he was a guy who just knew when to get in there and get out of there. It's more than I can say for a lot of you niggas.
But number one Lenny Bruce target was religion. He portrayed the big religions as big business and turned them into Religions Incorporated, with headquarters on Madison Avenue, which is where all the New York advertising companies have their offices.
Evening, gentlemen. Nice to see so many boys here tonight. I see religious leaders I haven't seen in many years. The graph here tells a story, that's about it. For the first time in 12 years, Catholicism is up 9 points. Judaism is up 15. The big P, the Pentecostal, is starting to move finally. And now, gentlemen, we've got Mr. Nick Dyer from our religious novelty house in Chicago, who's got a beautiful cellar. The genuine Jewish star, Lucky Cross, and cigarette lighter combined. And his wonderful little cocktail napkins with some hell of a sayings there. Another martini for Mother Gabrini.
Lenny Bruce's irreverence was always encouraged by his friend, his mentor and fellow comedian, Irwin Corey.
The role of a rebel is to break down the dark complacencies of the past and look for new horizons. And that's what Lenny Bruce did.
Lenny Bruce didn't grow up in radical surroundings. His home was a quiet, conservative backwater at the far end of Long Island. His father, who was a Jewish immigrant from England, had chosen to escape the ghetto atmosphere of New York City. Lenny was born in 1925. His real name was Leonard Schneider. His parents, Mickey and Sally, didn't stay together long. Sally's work was a strong early influence on Lenny. She was a singer and a dancer in clubs and vaudeville theatres. So he watched a lot of performers. And later he perfected his own routines in strip joints and jazz clubs. Professor Eric Mottram, who gives lectures about the 50s and 60s at London University, says that those early days planted the seeds of the unique Lenny Bruce style.
He learned to come onto the stage and deliver and engage the audience immediately, very much from working with jazz clubs and listening to those jazz improvisers, just doing that, coming onto the stage and blowing. And he imitated that very skillfully indeed. He comes on and he acts nervous. He acts vulnerable. This is a performance technique. He's not at all. He's worked this out. He's very secure. He knows the routines. What the audience sees is someone who is not secure. And then he slowly builds on that and fills them with ideas which apparently come out of uncertainty. In actual fact, they're very carefully planned. This is an amazing technique. And they begin to laugh nervously as they think, well, this man is overstepping the mark. He doesn't quite know what he's doing. Then they slowly realize that he's saying to them, I know you can't say this in the family, at the office, but I'm going to say it for you.
The routines were peppered with Yiddish words, but Irwin Corey says it would be quite wrong to call Lenny Bruce a Jewish comedian.
Well, Lenny Bruce was not a Jewish comic. Einstein was Jewish, but his E equals MC square could not be misconstrued as Hebraic.
Lenny's routines were always his own. He never used writers. Peter Cook was a great admirer. He enjoyed the improvising, the slow build-up.
Actual boom-boom jokes weren't his style at all. He was a genuine improviser. I mean, he had bits which he could fall back on, but he loved to go off on a complete limb. And he's very bold in that way.
And it was often almost surreal. Lenny did one sketch called Thank You, Masked Man. It's about the Lone Ranger and Tonto the Indian. He suggests that they had a very close relationship. Silver the Horse comes into it too. And even here, he's making fun of the enthusiasm at the time for prosecuting homosexuals for what the courts would keep calling unnatural acts.
I want Tonto. I want Tonto the Indian.
Damn you, freak. I want to tell you, what the hell you want Tonto for?
To perform an unnatural act.
What?
You heard me, to perform an unnatural act.
Masked man's a fag. Masked man, I never knew you were that way.
I'm not, but I've heard so much about it. You know, I like what they do with fags in this country. The punishment is quite correct and consistent with most of the law. They throw them in jail with a lot of men. Very clever. Wash them up and get them ready. And I tell you what, give me that white horse, too. What? The act.
Yeah. Get off and down to that. That's terrible.
Nothing was sacred. Not even Las Vegas. Why do people go to Las Vegas? For the casinos, yes. And they go there for the girls. Problem, how do you advertise the strip joint on the marquee outside over the pavement? Lenny didn't want any euphemisms.
You just can't put tits and ass up on a marquee. Why not? Why not? Because it's dirty and vulgar. That's why not.
Titties are dirty and vulgar?
No, it's the words, the way you relate. Are you sure it's the word, not the titty, that's dirty to you? It's the words, all right? Suppose we change the words to tuchuses and nay-nays. Well, that's a little better. That's interesting. You're not anti-Semitic idiomatic. You're anti-Anglo-Saxon idiomatic. So why don't we change it? Very austere, Latin. Gluteus maximus, pectoralis majors. Act about the cleanest. Clean to you, but dirty to the Latins. Or just code it and put T and A up there, man.
In his autobiography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, Lenny Bruce said, there is no right or wrong, just your right, my wrong. Everything is subjective. One of the things that he thought wrong was an official drive against pornography to protect children. He wondered, how about an official drive against vicious, violent movies to protect children?
The dirty movie for your child to see? The dirty book in the schoolyard? Or Psycho? Okay, what goes on in Psycho? The psychotic misogynist kills a beautiful woman for no purpose, stabs her blood down the drain, and then method of disposal of the body. They really get ponderous with it, wrapping in a shower curtain to the swamps and sump. This is not against the law, and I never hear the postmaster getting, why, that's bad for our kids to see. No, it's cool. Now, what goes on in the dirty movie? What are the couple doing in that picture? Any communist propaganda? Anyone getting slapped? Any violence? What are they doing, man? That's that offensive. But opposed to a killing, a blatant deterrent to life, What is that couple doing, man? I could get a judge that forbissing with it, man. What are they doing? So the values are for children to look at. Killing, yes, but stopping, no, man.
Diana Dawes said that the people Lenny Bruce shocked were usually hypocrites who didn't like what they heard him say because it was always the truth. His friend Erwin Corey says that Lenny Bruce had a pretty clear idea of his own about the things that he thought really obscene.
Obscenity, according to the dictionary, means that which is abhorrent to the eyes. And what was abhorrent to the eyes? Napalm bombs dropping on babies in Vietnam. Horses with their entrails sprawling over the debris. This is obscene. But to see a stag movie or an X-rated cinema, I mean, as Lenny would say, it's good for your breathing. In a society where sex is a commodity and a politician can become a TV personality, it's not easy to conform if you have any morality. And Lenny was that type of a guy.
When Time magazine attacked Lenny Bruce for being a sick comedian, he fought back. He raised the question of how badly school teachers are paid.
It's a disgrace, school teachers' salaries. Education is the answer to everything. World leadership hinges on education. Take Zsa Gabor, who get $50,000 a week in Las Vegas, and school teachers' top salary, $6,000 a year. This is really sick to me. That's the kind of sick material that I wish Time would have written about.
The serious comedian. His sense of humor was already a help to him in his early days. He was in the Navy in the Second World War and hated it. He managed to get himself dishonorably discharged by insisting that he was in grave danger of giving in to uncontrollable homosexual urges. He never, though, resisted heterosexual urges. He said that by the time he was 25, he'd dated at least 200 girls and been promiscuous with twice that number. Then he fell in love with a girl called Honey. She was a stripper. They married. It was a tempestuous, uncertain relationship. It was 1951. They started experimenting with drugs. Lenny grew increasingly dependent on narcotics, heroin eventually. His close friend, Paul Krasner, says that Lenny found a kind of paradise with drugs.
You know, you say, you don't know what it's like. It's like kissing God, you know, taking certain drugs. And he would talk. We would be there later, and he would say, I know I may, I'll die young. That was the context. I said, look, I may die young, but it's like kissing God. So when you're saying that, if he died young because of drugs, it would be worth it.
The experimenting with drugs and the gloomy fatalism matched a growing mood of the late 50s in America. Lenny was attracting a new audience, mainly students. They were worried about the never-ending witch-hunting of communists and the increasingly ominous involvement in Vietnam. Lenny Bruce said a lot of the things that they were thinking, so the clubs and the coffee houses booked him up. Some of his satire reflected his own personal disappointment. In 1956, after his daughter Kitty was born, his marriage to Honey collapsed.
The way, if you broke up and you go anyplace alone, there's always moms that ask about your wife. Where's your old lady? And I said, Chinese restaurants. Where's Mama? How come you're a big mom anymore? Such a beautiful girl running around here with Mama. But I'm divorced. Oh, you better off. You don't need her. Where's Mama?
One of Lenny Bruce's closest friends was the actress and singer Annie Ross. She says that he was old-fashioned and romantic. This is the first time that she's talked about him in a recorded interview since he died.
He loved to have you surrounded by things that he knew would make you happy. For example, when I went to see him at his home in California, the house that he built, I was picked up at the airport by a guy who was his chauffeur, and Lenny was working in a club, and we drove up to this house, and there was a note on the front door saying, welcome, darling, and there's food in the fridge, and there's a turkey in the oven, and the place was filled with flowers, and I mean, it was just, that was Lenny. He was a very, very giving man.
Peter Cook enjoyed being with Lenny Bruce. He says that he was engaging and likable, on and off stage.
people laughed because he was very, very funny. He used his body in a wonderful way, and when he became a character in his sort of duologues with himself, or used about four people at one time, he actually became those people. I hadn't realized, listening to the records, what a wonderful physical actor he was. He's also very appealing, sort of has a reputation of being like a sort of snarling Johnny Rotten in the old days type of performer. In fact, he was very genial, smiled a great deal, and was physically very handsome, attractive. Attractive, I'd have thought, to both sexes. I mean, he was extraordinarily good-looking. And he had enormous charm, which enabled him to do practically... I can't think of a subject he wouldn't do.
That was the trouble. As he innovated more and more, his acts took on an air of danger. Some sacred cows could not be touched without provoking an angry reaction. Pious outrage began to wreak its revenge in 1961. He was arrested for possessing narcotics, released on bail, and then 5 days later, arrested and charged with obscenity when he opened at a club in San Francisco. It was the beginning of 5 years of incessant prosecution, which ended with the death of Lenny Bruce. At the San Francisco trial, the presiding judge, Judge Axelrod, found him guilty of using obscene language. But then Lenny won the case on appeal, and Judge Axelrod, a name which was almost too good to be true, began to appear in the routines on stage.
Gig Axelrod, I warn you, Lenny Bruce, if you use the language that you used at that show, your appearance here, then I got completely out of it, you know. I said, you specifically warn me? Yes, I warn you that if you use, if I hear of those words, if I hear of those words, if he hears from somebody else that I talk dirty tonight, then I'll be in court again. The judge has heard the word hearsay so much he forgot what the hell it means. That's hearsay, hearsay, hearsay. It's like good night, good night, good night, good night. Thank you, hearsay. That's hearsay over Jack Overrule, over Jack the Rule.
Lenny Bruce did not coin the phrase, the law is an ass, but he might have done.
Well, the problem I had a long time with understanding the law is because of the language in the law and the fact that instead of taking each word and finding out the case that the word related to, once in a while I get lazy and I would apply common sense. And then I got really screwed up. Yeah.
In 1962, Lenny took a rest from the gathering legal storm. He went to England. They did let him in the first time. At number 18 Greek Street in Soho, Peter Cook was running a club called The Establishment. Other young performers there included Eleanor Bron, Alan Bennett, John Bird and Dudley Moore. Peter Cook went to meet Lenny Bruce off the plane, not knowing quite what to expect.
When he arrived at the airport, I'd booked a limo, a thing I hadn't even heard of before this, and out shambled this figure, mumbling away, with several tape recorders slung about him, listening to himself on one of them. And I said, Mr. Bruce, and he said, not as distinctly as that. Shoved him in the limo. I thought, oh, God, what have I booked? Here's a man who spent the entire flight taping himself, talking to air stewardesses. On the tapes, you could hear several surprised shouts of let go and things like that. He's obviously assaulting the air hostesses as well.
I'm a nervous nut anyway. I can usually make a plane for about an hour, and then I start to walk. I look at the signs, no fumare, occupado, fly pan air. Then I usually go in the men's room, I lock the door, and I make faces in the mirror of myself. Then I spite them, I drink the water. You're not supposed to, it's not for drinking, but I drink it anyway. Then I ring for the hostess. Those chicks will never come in the toilet with you, though, ever, yeah. I don't understand why they say that, ring for the hostess. What do you want? I can't tell you, come in here. They'll never come in there.
We bunged him along to this hotel and said, well, we'll give you a ring in the morning when you've got over your jet lag. Well, it doesn't look so much lag as death, really. We rang him in the morning, and he said he was about to be slung out of the hotel for some obscure reason. Could I find him somewhere else more suitable? So I went round to the hotel and discovered that, indeed, he was no longer a welcome guest, due partly to the fact that he had about 6 hookers up in his bedroom, and that the toilet facilities had been disturbed by the number of syringes placed down the loo. So he came to stay with me in my flat in Battersea. He said he needed some Dilaudid, which I discovered very rapidly as a heroin substitute. I mean, it's the same as heroin, which he wanted for his chronic back injury sustained during his heroic service in the Marines during the war. So here I am, a comparatively young man of 22 or 23, asked to get heroin in the middle of the night. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, I got back to the flat. And I said, "I'm terribly sorry, Lenny, but I couldn't get you any heroin." He said, "Oh, that's okay. Could I have some chocolate cake?" At which point, I got quite cross. I'd been trekking all around London looking for heroin. And I said, "Lenny, heroin at this time of night is feasible, but chocolate cake is completely out of the question. Go to bed."
Lenny alluded to airlines a lot. He invented one of his own, Non-Skedo Airlines, in which he takes you up to the flight deck with the captain and the co-pilot.
Where are we?
I don't know, man. I'm so loaded, that airport bar. I'm really juiced, man. I'm out of my nuts. Look, man, you promised you'd cool it, you know. Like, you can't make this scene, you know, out of your skull all the time. I know it's depressing, man. I don't dig height, you know. It's weird. Hey, what? Look, we gotta know where we are. Will you stop with that? They're lucky they get anywhere for $79 and shut up. Hey, what? What's that thing you're always grabbing here? That's a joystick. It moves the plane. You're putting me on. Let me see that. Is this a bit? It actually moves the wings. Is this weird? Look at the... Where'd you learn this bit? What was that? The back end of the plane just blew off. Cool it. 15 people just fell out. Are we going to get yelled at? There goes 6 more. Goodbye. Will you shut up with that? There's 20 people left. Let's dump them. What's the matter with you, you monster? You can't do things like that. They're awake.
Lenny was a great success at the establishment club in Greek Street, apart from a few people who walked out, including John Osborne, and the Daily Mail was lukewarm in its praise. Their critic thought him a stunted, creepy, defensive neurotic. It was when he tried to come back to Britain for another show the next year that the Home Secretary, perhaps thinking the same, decided it wouldn't be in the public interest to let him in. Back in the USA, Lenny was dragged into a chaotic succession of arrests for possessing narcotics and for using obscene language. The dirty words, though, were just a pretext. What the establishment could not and would not tolerate was his continual attacks on traditional cherished beliefs and on institutions like the Catholic Church. Lenny employed 21 lawyers in 5 years. He felt that he was being absurdly hounded.
It's an obscenity circus that's been going on for about 5 years. And I think that, I really can't believe that, that it's not settled yet.
In New York City, the police gathered evidence against him by fitting out a plainclothes officer with a concealed tape recorder and a microphone disguised as a type-in. They hoped to pick up any references to the Pope. They did. They stopped him going on for his second night. The arrests and the prosecutions wore Lenny down and affected his act. It got stale. His close friend, Paul Krasner.
He stopped reading newspapers and magazines and books, as he had been doing. He stopped going outdoors from his hotel room or from his home. He limited his environment. And because of this, when he performed, he had to resort a great deal to old bits. And because he was bored with them, because he had done them enough times, he would mumble through them. And so as a craftsman, he was being unfair to the audience. I said, "Hey, you know, remember you told me about how often a comedian should get laughs? And I noticed you're not doing that now." And he thought about it. He said, "Well, I'm changing." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he really, you know, stopped and called for a voice. I'm not a comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce.
And, of course, Lenny's close friend, Annie Ross, was all too aware of what was happening.
He looked bad. He was a very upset, worried, haunted man. He knew that they were out to get him, and he knew that he couldn't win. And I think anybody that feels that is bound to feel, you know, terrible pressure.
Lenny had built himself a bolt hole, a house on a hill outside Los Angeles. He died there in the bathroom on the 3rd of August, 1966. He was found naked on the floor with a needle embedded in his arm. He was 40 years old. The official cause of death was acute morphine poisoning. Accidental, not suicide. Some of his friends, though, think that he was murdered by somebody who supplied him with pure heroin and didn't tell him. Irwin Corey and Annie Ross are sure of it.
The point is this, that he was killed, and I'll tell you this, I don't care how many times people might refute it, but Lenny did have a pusher. Lenny did have a supplier. And it's the FBI that contacted his supplier and gave them the drugs that they ordinarily would give him, but they did not cut it. It was 100% pure. And if you take pure heroin at the doses that you ordinarily take just in order to relieve some symptoms, it would be misconstrued as an overdose. But no, it was an overdose. And it was done by the United States government.
He was delivered a death blow in the form of heroin that was of such a degree of strength that it would have killed anybody. And I think they wanted to silence him, and I think they did.
But however he died, he'd already been broken by the years of judges attacking him and officers busting his shows. Another of his friends said that he died of an overdose of police. His tragedy is that America was changing at the time that he died. A few years later, and those prosecutions for obscenity would have been much less likely. One of his prosecutors, Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Arthur Schaefer, changed his mind about Lenny Bruce too late.
Lenny had a message to convey and was sincere and honest about it. And his message was, I think, to expose and hold up a mirror to society so that they can really see themselves. And he used words as the weapons to hit them over the head with, to make them recognize that they're being hypocritical in every phase of their life.
Schaefer had realized that behind the outrageousness of Lenny Bruce, there was a blunt truth.
Now, what kind of crap is it to be able to say sexual intercourse and not the other? All people use these words, including the judge and the jury and everybody else. But you don't dare say that you use them.
Lenny decided that those were not sacred things to be shut away. He brought them out and he talked about them. That is why he ended so tragically, because he dared to tell the truth.
He was a universal iconoclast. That's what he was.
All rebels usually wind up paying for their rebelliousness, getting paid in kind for their rebelliousness, which is what happened to Lenny.
That portrait of Lenny Bruce brings to an end the series of Rebels, which has been written and presented by Hugh Sykes. The research has been by Dr. Mike Wolfe and the series producer, Gaynor Shute.